Tunisia. Tunisia.
Let me start this. Okay.
I have something to play here first. Tunisia was am I on?
Yep, you're on.
Tunisia was very interesting. As I don't know if I've stated this before. As you get older, you get repetitious, but I'll say it again. Tunisia is one of the most interesting places that I ever saw, along the coast from Algiers to Tunis to Bizerte. It was fabulous. There are wheat fields, cork forests, oak field, oak trees, and they had some trees with the roots sticking above the ground. The boys used for making pipes. They took hacksaws. They did that in their spare time. They made all kinds of design, and when they were waiting. There's a lot of time to kill when you're in a service like that, sometimes, and when you're not fighting. Anyway, it was an interesting experience. It was all the way to all the coast from Algiers right up to Tunis there, along that coast there. It was absolutely fabulous. Beautiful. They had big waves. I was swimming there down in Oran once, and I almost didn't make it back. I got carried out, and it was humongous waves that were they were pounding the shore. I just wanted to dive in them, and I did it. And I didn't stay there. So I'm gonna play some. Recording that I have thought about since you were here last, and I put it on tape, and I thought you should have this, and so I'll play it now. Oh, wait a minute, I have to rewind that, don't I? I forgot. Sorry.
It's okay. Don't think it's rewinding.
Oh, okay. Anyway, here we go.
VA Veterans Administration. So the class action brought about by the tobacco companies against the tobacco companies, an award in excess of $100 billion was awarded by a jury. It was dismissed even though
I was supposed to be in there.
illness brought about by addicted
Are you gonna
addicting
you're gonna
tobacco addicting tobacco were not dismissed. And a settlement of less than $1 billion was allowed. A partial settlement was laid on this injured tobacco users. And at present, the balance is not being dispersed and is being denied by a claim by the Veterans Administration against them. Now, my claim against the VA is this: a fire was allowed to proceed that destroyed all our records and my ju records. In my judgment, deliberately, as they sought many claims against the UA by injured veterans. They just let it burn. I myself was injured three times, plus I contracted eight cases of malaria. It is my claim I would have been eligible of disability claims of a sizable amount. But due to the VA's negligence, I am denied recompense. At the present time, I'm suffering a disability from cancer and cannot receive the treatment in the USA. It could be determined in a they could be obtained in a foreign country for the cost of $5,000, which I am unable to afford. So the tobacco injured sufferers are not allowed a small insignificant settlement because the VA is asking a judgment of our small sawmill to which they are
I didn't know that was on there.
Okay.
I did not know.
In all fairness,
but it's past that.
We should have more money. The VA is miserly and injurious to wounded veterans The VA is miserly and injurious to the wounded veterans like myself. Do not have equitable representation. I am asking for inquiry into the cause and effect of the St. Louis fire by a grand jury. The VA.
You can block that out later.
Inquired a Vanguard mutual fund of my investments with them, and they were advised of my holdings by Vanguard to the VA.
This is true.
Enclosures. Who are the VA working for? Surely not the veterans. CC to head of VA. Respectfully yours, Richard A. Williams. There was a time during World War II, I don't know how many years I'd been overseas by this time, when I was it was one time, and there was a short duration, but it was a great depression settled on me, and I at that time I would have accepted a dishonorable discharge to the better shed of the war. It passed, though, and later I reverted to my usual stoic self with my bravado and continued my exploits with the armed forces with gusto and relished what I was doing. But this one time in my life over there was a very depressing time. It was a very short duration. I don't remember how long. It was just a few, maybe a day. But it was so depressing that you would accept a dishonorable discharge to have been removed from the scene. And
didn't last a day.
That was another
few
period
hours.
When I was, it happened that it was in a half an hour, and it was over with. But I was depressed. I really, well, I don't know. I was homesick, I guess, lonesome, homesick, and I actually broke down and cried in a truckload of guys with me there, and they understood. They knew, because I'm sure they'd felt the same despair at times as I did then. These are rare instances in your life when you come through and you face up to the realization and you return to your normal self. There's also an incident in I never mentioned it before, but I should have. It was regarding going ashore in North Africa. The smell, the scent was different. Sicily was too. I had a different odor. And it wasn't the pizza. I don't know what it was.
Sicily
it was
had a different odor.
Maybe the earth or the surrounding or the in Sicily it could have been in unsanitary conditions. They used to throw their slop jars out in the street from upstairs. When you went through a town, you wore your helmet. There was a cartoon about that and Yank Magazine. But they all had different odors. The odor wasn't the same odor in it was a sterile odor up in Tunisia. It was a desert. But back in Algiers, Oran, there it was in Algeria also, not just in Oran, but I also noticed it there when I walked through the Casbah, that there was a different odor completely than any place I'd ever been before. They had meat hanging out on racks that was putrefied by black flies. It was covered with black from the flies that excreted on a thing, and it was all, if I had eaten it, it probably gave me ptomaine poisoning, but they were used to it, so it was something that they, it didn't bother them. But I thought I should bring this subject up. This is regarding southern Tunisia. I remember the incident. I don't remember exactly where or when it happened, but I know it was in the beginning of the campaign in Tunisia, and I was in southern Tunisia, and I was sitting down with my back against some stones, and my knees tucked up, my head turned down, so my helmet protected my head. And our artillery was going over, outgoing. It was our artillery going overhead, sounded like a freight train. There was so much of it, and there was. Occasionally, a rotary band. There's two rotary bands around the shell it's soft material that ride the rifling in the barrel of the cannon to give it the spin. And sometimes these rotary bands will break loose from the shell as it goes over, and as it does, it's spinning and all, and it hits the rocks and it goes bing bong bong, and I got a piece of one right through my knee, and it felt hot, that's all, but there was no pain there. And they wanted to send me back to the hospital, and I told them I don't want to go to the hospital. I don't need to. I was afraid they might send me to another unit, and I love that unit I was in. I had close attachments there with most of the men I was with, and I was proud of that unit, 1st Infantry Division, 26th Infantry Regiment. In my opinion, it was the best unit going, and I didn't intend to leave it, so I said I'll patch it up myself, and I did, and I gave myself a shot of penicillin, and later that night, before I went to sleep, I gave myself a shot of morphine. I was having some pain then, but that passed before I got up in the morning, and anyway, I bandaged my knee up. And there was two holes. It's right around it was right around the patella, the kneecap, and it went to the left of the inside of the right knee, and it exited, and it healed in a few days, and I take the band. I had a band. I was limping. But I got motivated, and I didn't. I was satisfied with it, and that's what happened to my first wound. Mechanization, no trucks, they used that, and that's what he was up there for, and he did a good job.
Do you remember his rank?
I don't know. I don't know. Okay, it went in here, and it came out over here. Later on, I used to get water on the knee from that thing. When I climbed mountains, I used to climb mountains like that. So we left Tunisia, am I on?
Yep.
We left Tunisia and I, we went down to, some of the unit went to, back to Oran, but a few of us were kept in, just west of Algiers, and a town called Blida. And we were encamped there until we left for Sicily. And we'd get down to the Algiers and wander through the Casbah and area. Usually you try to have a buddy with you. You wouldn't do it alone because somebody maybe might consider you a viable victim. they wouldn't have hesitated to wrap you in the head and made off with your contents, whatever you had. And anyway, we were there for a while. The weather was good. On the way back from Tunisia to Blida, we went through the Atlas Mountains. It was up high and it's still spring. There's snow on the ground up there. And this one incident we came past was Arab farmer with he had a yoke for two oxen. He only had one oxen, so his wife was hooked up with the in tandem with the other oxen, and they're walking barefooted through this snow covered ground plowing the field. It shows how the Arabs took care of their women. I thought it was a cruel thing. It was shocking to see, even for the Arab, the man had, he was shoeless also, and so was she, and they had little clothes on, but that's how they plowed their field. Interesting, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't remember, you don't forget these things. They're antithesis to our way of life in the United States. We're brought up that way. We're brought up to love and protect our women, not to use them for the... But anyway, while we left Blida, we went on and got aboard ship in Algiers to go to Sicily, and we had gliders with troops. They had troop carrying gliders, and they were being towed by the C-47s, and they went over as our Navy went was our was our protector when we went ashore. We didn't have the English, so we just went ashore. The English, the British 8th Army landed in what is called Syracuse. It's on the east coast of Sicily. And I later had occasion to go through there, and it was beautiful with old Greek and Roman ruins in there.
Nothing like Syracuse, New York.
No, it wasn't like Syracuse, New York, no. we landed in Gila, G-I-L-A, in the south coast, and it was at night when we were landing there, and they... we weren't getting much resistance from the Germans, They had made arrangements through the mafia. I can't think of the name of that one guy. He was in jail in New York, and they allowed him to be exported back to Sicily, and he made arrangements for the mafia to aid and assist us in our landing and going through these towns, which they did.
So the mafia was assisting the U.S. Army.
Yes, they were.
Okay. In what ways?
Huh?
In what ways did they help?
Well, they kept us informed of where the Germans were, and they would make sure that any provisions that was available, we got some, you know, fresh fruit or whatever, which we didn't need. But anyway, we half the unit was down with malaria. We didn't get any in Africa where you would expect it. But Sicily was a deplorable place. Very poor there. What the mafia didn't own, the church owned. There was a very degrading place. The British Eighth Army were also, they'd come over from Tunisia also. They landed, and they were down, half of them were down with malaria. Probably the British or the German Rommel's outfit that had escaped over there on their way to Italy they were probably some of them were incapacitated. But we had some battles up there in Caltanissetta and minor battles, a 2 or 3 day skirmish on the way up. And the main battle was at Troina. It was just at the foot of Mount Etna in Sicily, right across from the straits of Messina to going to Italy. And they were fighting a rear guard action. They had all these men, and they probably had some wounded and sick people there. They were trying to get out of there. And we got a fierce battle at Troina. And I was there, but I had been in one of the hospitals I was in. It was in a civilian building. I had it many times. I had malaria there, and I was in a civilian building, and it was up on a second floor, and I could look out the window, and down below was this woman with a big, about a 4 foot square tray with just an edge along the with tomatoes in there. The tomatoes were black with flies, specks, and so forth. And she would mash them up and squash them up with her hands. And she had to blow her nose. She just held her finger to her nose over the side and blew it and the other way. So later, some of the boys were invited out to dinner to have pizza with these families, and I declined what I saw. I didn't want to eat.
Did the Army anticipate that you were going to have problems with malaria? Did they hand out tablets or anything?
Yeah, we had Adabrin. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did. We had Adabrin, but it wasn't effective.
Okay.
If you ate too much Adabrin, it'd turn you yellow. That you'd think you had jaundice. But we had when you became sick with malaria, you had the shakes. You run a high fever, and then you get the chills. They put blankets on you, 4 or 5 blankets on you. You're still cold, shaking, and this went on. for, oh, maybe a day or two. I had two different types. I had falciparum and tertia. The falciparum I had it once. It was one you don't get a recurrence of, but it can be fatal. It gives you a very high fever. I had a temperature there. That one I was in a field hospital, and I had a temperature 108. I was unconscious for 3 days. And I finally came, woke up when I became conscious and so forth. And there's a nurse nearby, and I asked her where's the restroom. I had to go to the bathroom. She said, "I'll get you a bedpan." And I, of course, you're macho. You can't allow that to happen. I said, no, I'll make my way there. And so she said, "Well, it's out the back of the tent to your left." I got out of bed and I just collapsed down on the ground. So I couldn't just sit there and let her come over and help me with that. I had to be my own man. So I got pulled myself up and I stood up for a few minutes until I was able to regain my balance, and then I slowly marched myself out the back end of the tent. I came back in, and I think the lady, she was very kind. The American nurses over there were angels. They were truly doing everything they could to comfort us and so forth. And that was with the falciparum. That was the one. You don't get a recurrence from it. But the tertia, and that was the one I had, it's not as severe, but you get recurrences from that one. And that's the one I had recurrences. Your spleen becomes enlarged, carrying the dead blood cells off and so forth. And it's a weakening condition. And I was able to get back to the outfit and we're on our way up to north there, and I had to go to we're just approaching Troena in the northern part of the island, and it's up on the north coast, and I took a water tank truck to go back to get our supply of water, and it had to be chlorinated so that it'd be safe to drink. And we used to have Lister bags. I think they're called Lister bags. It's been a long time. And there were big canvas bags with nozzles on the bottom. You push it, the water comes out. And that's how they gave it they had those hanging around there for people to help themselves, fill their canteens with, and so forth. But I had to go back with this truck, and as we passed, we was going back, and as we got to the place, and I checked the truck out, and he was on his way back, and there was this girls hanging off the balconies up overhead, and nothing would do, but I had to go and investigate it. So I told them to let me off and I'll make my way back. I made the mistake of going up there, and this girl came in and tended to me. And it was on clean white sheets, soft mattress, and I immediately passed out. And I was there at 2 o'clock in the morning. I came to, and my God, this is bad. You know, I just got the Bronze Star and my staff sergeant chevrons, and they weren't too happy about this. And I got back, and Mike Cowell, he really chewed me out, and he had every right to. And I that was the only time I let him down. But I'm sorry I didn't look him up later. He came from Rochester, New York, and I was in Binghamton, New York. I should have gone up and seen him. I didn't. But at that time, I was having trouble with nightmares, and I didn't want to be reminded of other people there. at that time of my life there. But we, when we came down, it was a real battle up there. We had to go through the town of Troina and house to house, and we had casualties, heavy casualties out of that. And sometimes you had to carry the men a great distance to get to where an ambulance could get. It was so rocky up there, and they would carry them on a litter great distances. So we captured Troina, and that was they had made their way across the strait. The Germans had made their way across the Straits of Messina, and you could see the smoke curling out of Mount Etna up there to your south, and we were down at the foot of it, and that was it. Then they took us down. We went back down south, and we landed at the top. When we landed there, we were standing at the railing. Mike Cowell and I were standing at the railing, watching these planes go over, and our own aircraft was shooting them down. They were coming from the south. Why they were doing that, I do not understand. But they should have known they were our planes. They came from the south. Germans would have come from the north. But they shot them down. We were shooting down our own planes, and it was sad to see, because you know these guys are in there, and they got killed, and it was quite a bit of that going on, and it was Mike Cowell was a Jewish guy, he was a major, and he says, it's too bad I'm not there's not going to be a synagogue here, because he would like to have gone to a synagogue. It was sometime their Jewish holiday. And I said, why are there any Jewish synagogues on this island? He says, well, they're agricultural, and we are not agricultural people. And that's how he explained it to me. He was a nice guy. He talked to him without any offense. They're talking about his religion and so forth. What he intended to do after the war. He was a wonderful guy. We loved him dearly. And but they took us down to a little town called, just west of Gila, a town called Lakata. And it was on the coast, and we were in occupation there. And they had men, riflemen out guarding railroads, in case there was any Germans wandering around, going to do damage to our rite of passage on the road or a railroad or whatever. Anyway, this guy told me about this one night. He was a rifleman, and he was in this underpass. There was a road that went under some railroad tracks, and he was guarding that. And this man came up to him with a 12-year-old girl, 11, 12-year-old girl, and he was pimping for her. He was her father. And he, you know, I mean, he was turned off. He told the man no, that he wasn't interested. And I guess he thought maybe he swung the other way, so he offered him to do a homosexual oral sex act on him. And that really turned him off. Get out of here, he said. He chased him the hell away. This was a very depressing, where people resorted to this kind of treatment of their own offspring. Repulsive, utterly repulsive. We were there we used to get haircuts or shaves. The kids in town had go along with they had a one-legged stool, and they had a mug with a brush in it and a safety razor, and they had a razor strap hanging from their belt. These are young kids, 10, 12, something. And they, you go in, and just for a few lire, you'd get a shave. It was the best shave you ever had. I mean, they really had a light touch, and it was great. It was wonderful to have this, and it was quite a different kind of a thing. That's how they made a living. Well, we were there for a while, and then we went. We had to go over to Syracuse to board our ship to go back to England, and I was on a ship. There was a ballast. It was empty, completely empty. I was topside. I had a paperback I was trying to read, and I was getting sprayed, and it was cold there. The wind off in the water was cold, and so I went down back. I went down in the hold of the ship, and there must have been a submarine nearby because they were equipped with depth charges. They would launch those depth charges, and I was down in the center of this empty boat, a big victory ship or liberty ship, an 8 or 10,000 ton vessel, and it sounded like it was inside of a drum. And this went on for a while, and they got rid of the submarine. And I read my book down there, and as we went through Gibraltar, and you always like to watch the going passage through Gibraltar, because you can see from one side, you can see the Rock of Gibraltar on one side, and you can look across the Straits of Gibraltar and see where the Arabs were We were a sitting duck there, but it was pretty safe. And then we went up and we went in to the in between Wales and Ireland. And as we were going in there, there was a submarine sitting on the surface. He was incapacitated. He couldn't move, and he couldn't maneuver to get in the position to fire torpedoes at us, they got in communication with the boat, and they found it was disabled, and they shot us. All of these freighters that we were on all had a 5-inch gun on the bow. They had a crew there, about 12-15 men. Crew that were working and relays and shifts, and they fired a bow shot over the bow of the submarine. The submarine raised a white flag, and so they sent a few men aboard there, and they escorted it into Liverpool, and that was when I was in Liverpool. They took charge of the German submarine. And we were taken by truck to an encampment that we were in. And that was when Mike Cowell, thought he was doing me a favor, I guess. I don't know what the hell he thought. I didn't join. He told me that he knew that I was in dentistry and I was good at what I did. And he I did it before the war and after the war. He said that there was a dental clinic at Cheltenham, England, and it was right near Wales. And at that time, I wasn't interested in my Welsh heritage, so I didn't make an attempt to go over to Wales. I should have asked for a pass. I'm sure I got one. But I didn't. Anyway, I was interested in getting back to the outfit. I didn't want to stay there. I was in this dental clinic, and I was there 2 months when a colonel of the clinic came by one day, and he says, you don't like it here, do you? And I says, no, I don't think I belong here. I says, is that your way of telling me my work is unsatisfactory? No, your work is excellent. We'd like to have you stay here, but we wouldn't want you to stay if you're going to be unhappy. I said, couldn't look myself in the face morning sitting here, and my outfit's going to go across. I've had experience as a combat medic, and they're going to need me over there. And he said, well, there's going to be thousands, maybe tens of thousands died. He was trying to dissuade me from going. I said, have you ever been in combat? He said, no. I said, well, believe me, when you go in combat, you don't worry about dying. You don't think about it. If you did, you'd be distracted, and then you would get knocked off. But you go into combat with one thing in mind, is how to pursue what your job is, and take cover and do it the best you can without getting yourself shot. And I said, you know, if you don't let me go back voluntarily, I'm gonna walk out of here, and I'll hitchhike down to Weymouth. I think that's where my outfit was, and it was. They were there, right on the coast, just south of us. And I says, I'm gonna go down there, and I'll stow away on a goddamn boat, but I'm not gonna sit here play with teeth. I didn't join the army to play with teeth. I joined the army to fight a war. They attacked us, and I volunteered for D-Day. So there you go. Now, what do you think of that?
It's amazing.
And I joined the outfit, and I was there, and I happened to come on one night. I had a bottle of a gin. Are you out of water?
No, I'm fine.
Huh? I got some more.
No, I'm fine. I'm fine. That's good.
Well, I need some more. I need to wipe my whistle. Now we're coming to the interesting part of the story here. This is D-Day. But before D-Day, when we were waiting to board ship and so forth, I come in possession of a bottle of gin. Very hard to come by. Ordinarily, I don't like gin. But we're trying to anesthetize ourselves to what was coming up. And I was a half crocked. I drank about a third of the bottle. And these guys wanted it from me, and they kicked the crap out of me to get the bottle of gin. They knocked me out, as a matter of fact. Because at 2 o'clock in the morning, I woke up. And here's the church bells chiming. And it's foggy, overcast. I'm not a religious man. I have no, but I've heard of purgatory. And I says, it must be purgatory. I'm in purgatory. It was horrible. And I never did ever get that drunk again. I never would. I wouldn't allow myself to get that in that state. But I was feeling, I went back and went to bed. And if I could have found those guys, I would have beat their head in with a tire iron. Anyway, they got my gin, and I, in a day or two, we left. We went across, and it was the back end of a storm. It was the intermission of a storm on D-Day, as everybody recalls, if you read about it anyway, and the seas were still built up from that storm that passed us. And we got over to Normandy, and on the way there, when you wear dog tags, you have a shoestring or a chain or something to hold your dog tags around your neck. And they all chafe your neck. They chafe your neck. So going on our way in, I saw this paratrooper. He had got tangled up in his shrouds, and he is hanging down there. He's drowned. And I thought, saw those shrouds, and I said, my God, that's just a thing for put my dog tags on. So I had a guy hold my belt when I reached over, whacked off a 4-foot piece and stuck it in my pocket, which I later put my dog tags on. And then I got, after later, it's civilian life, it's the same reason the French didn't want to see anything on the beach over there. They didn't want to be reminded of the damn war, neither did I, and I threw my dog tags away. Now I'd like to have them. I would have had it right here. And anyway, because that guy gave his life for me to get there. When I was at, turn it off, man. Okay, I'm gonna revert back to Tunisia, and we were getting up near Lekef, and so they told me I had a six-man detail that I was in charge of to take out. There's some German paratroopers, there's about 15, 20 of them, and they dropped, and all their chutes, none of their chutes opened. They were laying out there in the desert for two or three or four days, and their every bone in their body was broken, and they were just bloated up, and the smell was ghastly. If you ever smell a dead rotting body, be glad if you haven't, because it was ghastly. It was terrible. And so, anyway, we had shovels and trenching tools. We had to dig a trench beside them, and they had two dog tags the same as we do. When you take one of the dog tags and you take the other one and you pry their mouth open, their mouth is shut, but you take your point of your shovel and shove it in their mouth and break their teeth in the process and pry their mouth open, and you shove the dog tag down their throat so it'll be in the body when they find them. That's as close as I wanted to come to them. So we had their dog tag, but these guys were, my detail there wanted souvenirs. And these guys had these daggers with a swastika on the hilt, you know, anything with a swastika on it was real hot stuff. They wanted that. And these guys were going through their body, maggots crawling around in there and in and out. I didn't even want to be standing near them. And it was horrible. I said, "What the hell are you guys doing?" They said, "We're looking for souvenirs." And I said, "Well, if you don't mind getting your hands in the maggots and dead flesh, go ahead. But get them buried. And I want the dog tags." I counted. I said, "There's about, 13, 14, 15 guys there, Germans, and whoever folded their parachute was working for us, because not a one of them opened." So we cut the parachute off and then dig a trench next to them and take the shovel and shove them in the cover them over. That took better part of an afternoon to get these guys dug in and covered up. The smell was so horrible, and it gets in your body, it gets in your hair, all through your clothes. And I got back to camp, and the smell, I mean, I couldn't, I just, it'd make you throw up if you, you couldn't eat food, you didn't want to be, so I took my clothes, and I dipped them in gasoline, and hung them on a branch there to get rid of the odor. And I washed myself with gasoline. Fortunately, nobody came around with a lighted cigarette or something, because I'm still alive. But that's how you got rid of the odor. It was ghastly. Mm. Ghastly. You ever smell a dead body? Mm-mm. That's terrible. It's the worst odor in the world. So we got those buried. That was in Tunisia. Now we're on our way back to England. So I was back Weymouth, and we're back in England now, and I'm not surprised I didn't tell you that story. Mm-mm. That was a good one.
No. I read it in the manuscript. But
oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah.
But okay.
I didn't hear it.
Well, I thought you should hear it. First class, first person. I didn't want any more burial details. But you put a stick up there so that they can identify where they are. And when there's a squad comes around and they disinter them there later, they have nowhere to dig. Mm-hmm. And they put a stick by each one of them there. Okay. I got ashore in Normandy, and I got on my lighter. I was ashore, and a rifleman. There was another medic, and we were going ashore.
Whereabouts did you land?
Omaha Beach. As we were carried a little that morning, we were a third wave. Our 26th was a third wave. The 16th, 18th, and 26th regiments. The 16th was the first wave in the morning, and they went ashore in a bad place. And it was right where all the artillery and mortar were concentrated, and they took heavy, heavy casualties. And bodies were stacked up and floating. Now, the water in the English Channel along that coast there is just to the east of Cherbourg Peninsula. And Cherbourg Peninsula sticks up, and it creates a vortex, a whirlpool in there. And the water out in the main body of water in the English Channel goes from west to east. But there's right next to shore there, the water was going from east to west, and it carried a lot of bodies down there. We were carried about close to a mile. West of our designated landing area, and it was fortunate for us we were, because we got rifle. We didn't get any heavy weapons, no artillery or mortars. We got rifles, and they were bearing down on us too. As the gate dropped, it was quiet. The sound was absolutely quiet. We came to he turned the motor off, you know, or Tom turned it down, and you could hear the wave slapping the boarding gate until the gate went down, exposing us to the fire from the cliff. And the first thing you could think of is how to get to a pylon or a dead body to get behind. And blind instinct takes you to these things. I was favored to be able to, when I was under stress, I functioned best under stress. I didn't think about the situation or the danger I was in or anything. Later, after the war, you think about it, not now. Anyway, you don't think about that. You're thinking about getting behind. You could see where shots were landing. You avoided that, and you try to get to behind a pylon. They are like railroad ties, three of them sticking up in there, and there are obstacles for the tanks and landing craft. And we use them for protection. We get behind that or a body. So there was a rifleman on board, and he was going to be a brave guy, big guy, and he was going to make a dive for the foot of the cliff. And he got out about 50 foot, and he took one right through the top of the right thigh. Mm. And I couldn't see any blood. I saw him there, and he wasn't bleeding much. It must have hit a nerve, though, because he was in pain. He knew I was there. Hi, medic! Hey, medic! And I says, I see you. I said, stop thrashing around or there, use your photographer practice. So he stopped. I says, I'll get out to you when I can get out there and not get my ass shot off. So you crawl around, you roll through the water, through the surf. I grabbed him by the collar, get him behind a pylon. I dressed his wound there, and he was in pain. He wanted morphine. I says, he was bigger than you, as big as you, stockier. Mm-hmm. And I says, I can't give you morphine because I'm going to need your assistance to get you aboard that lighter, because the lighter that we just come in on was just backing out, and the pilot could see what was happening, and he slowed down. And I got the guy, I put a tourniquet on him in case it was near a vein or an artery down in his leg, and it created an aneurysm, and then he'd bleed to death on the way out. So I put a tourniquet on him. I gave him a shot of penicillin and put a bandage on his wound, and I dragged him out, and he half walked out. He came, he was a help. It was a big, I said, you got to help me. And I got him, and the guy came in with a lighter. He dropped the gate. I grabbed the guy by the seat of the pants, and he grabbed the ribs on the boarding gate and pulled himself up. And then they raised the boarding gate up, and the guy dropped down on the floor there at safety, whatever safety there was to be had at the time, because there were ricocheting bullets going off the barge, and off he went. Now I gotta go to the bathroom.
Yep.
Am I on?
Yeah.
Well, I got that guy, that rifleman, back aboard a lighter, and they probably took him to a hospital ship out in the channel. So I had to get back, and I rolled myself back and I crawled. If you stood up, you were dead. I mean, you couldn't stand up. You rolled. You rolled in the sand and the surf, the water, and it was cold. You don't think you were. It warmed you up thinking about the bullets buzzing around you, buzzing like bees. You get behind a body. And if they were shooting, if they shot at the body, some of them were alive. And if they were dead, it made a plunk sound when the bullet hit them. And if they were still alive and there was blood, they had circulation of blood, a splashing sound. So you could tell the dead from the if the living were alive when the bullet hit them, they were dead then. So anyway, you'd use them for protection, those in the pylons. You're a long ways away from shore, from the earth. You're a long ways away from the foot of the cliff. And it graduated as you went further west. The beach graduated closer to the cliff. And your idea was to get yourself west as far as you can, get close enough. And I was rolling for bodies. There were bodies in there, and it occurred to me that there might be some live ones. So I would feel right in here is a carotid artery, and on the left side is the strongest. And you feel up in there, and I didn't feel any pulse there for the first four or five guys. The one I did, I could just feel a pulse. I didn't look to see his wounds. If they had arms or legs off, you knew they were dead. They bled to death. But if they were just a pulse and there was they're intact, the body was intact. I didn't look to see where the wound was. I just dragged him down to the surf. It was hard work. You're dragging them down. You can't. They're moving, and they could see movement down there from the cliff. The Germans, and they were shooting at you. And I got six guys down there that way. I drag them down, and if there was a lighter there that had just offloaded, I'd put them on that. If there weren't, I'd lay them against a pylon and try to keep their head out of the water until I'd come back down there and or they could be found, and somebody would load them on a lighter. I got six guys that way. I don't know if they lived or died. There was a faint pulse, that's all. Mm-hmm. Just enough to let you know that they're still alive. I couldn't see the wound. Maybe they'd lost some blood and it was unconscious or something. I don't know. Maybe they all died. I don't know. But it bothered me that these guys were alive. And I got later, it bothered me very badly. That was one of my bad nightmares I had, thinking about the thousands of guys that died on that beach. There were hundreds still alive, and I rescued six of them. And it bothered me that there weren't more medics, more people to help, but they couldn't do it. You couldn't do it. I had to get out of there myself, or I'd have been killed, because they were concentrating their fire. They started really concentrating on me, and I would have been killed if I'd have stayed there. I had to get out of there. And then if I killed down there, I wouldn't have been any good to the guys up on the cliff. So I had to leave them. That bothered me. So I got myself back along. It was starting to get dark. Over there, you're at a higher latitude and it stays light longer, long time. It was starting to get dusk, and I was close enough to I made a mad dash for the foot of the cliff. I hesitated there, and I wasn't getting any shots in my direction. So I worked my way up the cliff quiet as I could. In the meantime, when I was down there, in between breaks, when I was taking bodies out. I had a D ration. That's a chocolate bar. It has a lot of nourishment in it, and it's fast energy. And I nibble on that. It was a pretty good sized bar, probably about 6-7 inches long, and it's square, about an inch and a half square, something like that. And it is fast energy and good nourishment. And I ate that. And I worked my way up to the top of the cliff. I had some other emergency rashes, but I didn't feel like eating anything. I was too exhausted. I went to sleep. I slept and I woke up in the middle of the night. You don't sleep very long. There's firing. You're still firing around you. And it keeps you awake. But anyway, you get a little rest. You get some shut eye. And at false dawn, not dusk, just at fault, or not too dark, not too light. It wasn't getting light yet. It was false dawn. And you could make the outline. You could see silhouettes of men. And I saw these guys, and you could tell from their helmets, the German and Americans. And I saw their Americans. And I said, "Are you with the 26th? And they said, "Yes." I said, "Where's the medics?" And they said, "Over the cliff there." I said, "What are you guys going to do?" "We're going to do some patrol activity and reconnoiter. And we'll send reports back." I said, "You should have a medic with you. How many man patrol are you going to send out?" "Three man patrols." I said, I'll go over there and I'll get some medics and I'll bring them back so that you're going to have a medic with you on each patrol. They should each have a patrol, have a medic with them. And I don't remember losing any of them. Then later they did. But they got information and then they sent it back. They got a runner and they sent it back with a runner up ahead. And they went past. They were going west. We were headed west and south. And so that we were there. We had food. We got around some other, the main body in about a week, 10 days, the main body of the battalion. I was with the 1st Battalion. I was in charge of the battalion aid station. No litter bearers, no. I had my Musette bag with morphine and bandages, tourniquets, and that's it. So that went on, and I got out, I come across Bobby Cromarty, my buddy, and Bobby and I arranged to set up an aid station. We got a Jeep, and put a Jeep across that, and we used that for an aid station, and then we'd get litter bearers and send them back with any wounded, and that went on for about another week. And then by that time we were going west and south, and we come under the main body of the regiment. And about that time I was out in the middle of a field someplace. Somebody said there was wounded up there. I went out there. There was a house, a farmhouse, and there were shooting. I could hear tanks in the distance. And there were artillery was shooting towards the farmhouse, between me and the farmhouse. And I didn't do anything. The artillery fire lifted. I made a dash for the farmhouse. I get inside, and there's a young woman about 20 hunkered underneath the kitchen table. And so we both did, and you know what happened then, huh? You might as well die happy. So I gave her some food when I left there, and I ran off and got to try to get back the outfit. I didn't see any casualties. And then later we were moving and still west and south, and I took one and my arm. I had my arm that was firing, it's well on fire. You put your helmet down, your head down with your helmet on there, and I pull your head out, and I got two of them right here. Mm. And I got one there, and then I got a recurrence of malaria. Every time I got wounded, I got a recurrence of malaria along with it.
Jeez.
And so I'm bleeding and having this, and I, the only way I could, they were busy. I said, Bobby, you're in charge. So he was in charge of the aid station. I got a ride over to a field hospital. I said, their field hospital right south of St. Marie Angeles. That was where the paratroopers had dropped, and one of them was hanging from a church steeple up there. You heard that one?
No.
No?
Mm-mm.
One of the paratroopers from the paratroop dropped at night, and they were off, and there was between them and the beach, there was a shallow place that the Germans had flooded it. And some men were in there in 6 foot of water, and they drowned in that thing. They landed in there. And then they landed on a church. They had some spires sticking up off the church, and one of the guys' parachute hung onto that, and he was hanging there. I guess the Germans took them down, and then the Americans came in, and they captured the Germans, and so he was released, and he wasn't even wounded. Today, over in that church over in St. Maria Angeles, there's a paratrooper, a dummy, that the people were there to honor them, and I didn't know it. I never went inside that church, and it was later. They told me that one of the stained glass windows has a paratrooper. If I ever get over there again, I'm going inside, see that stained glass window. I'll take a picture of that. Anyway, right south of there was a field hospital, and I got a ride in a Jeep, and a guy took me over there, and I got to the field hospital, there was another guy from my outfit there, and he was Irish as Paddy's pig, and he spoke French like a native. He was brought up in Lille, France. His father was a representative for International Harvester. And when he was the same age I was, when he was 18, he was 1938, his father could see the handwriting on the wall, and they went back to the States. And here he was back over there. And so he and I, they were going to send us to a replacement depot. And we're getting ready to be released. We've been there 2 weeks. 10 days, 2 weeks, our arm was healed, stopped bleeding. The temperature had gone down. So we decided to just take off for the outfit. I said, the Germans on the runs, let's cap. We could hear heavy bombardment. There's St. Louis sites south of us. We got down there, and they had just broke through at St. Lowe. That was, they went south to Le Mans, and then they went east. And then they sent a regiment up towards Felice, and the German and the English were coming down, so they met at Felice, and there was a German encampment there. Or a German, there's 200, there's quarter million Germans, prisoners.
In the camp.
And there was some dead, planes. Later I heard the pilots would say that they could smell the dead up in the air.
This is a German POW camp.
German dead from the fleece pocket. We'd surrounded them. Some of them escaped. They made their way east. But they could, it was just like that time I was on a burial detail, you know. I mean, the odor was up there, you know, ghastly. And these planes, they could smell it up in the air. But we worked our way into We were riding on jeeps. They were going east. There was no resistance. The Germans were all captured there, and they were shipping them out. They were taking them down to the beach and shipping the Germans out of to prisoner of war camps. 250,000 of them. We were on our way east, and we got out Chartier. One of the trucks says, I says, "Where are you going?" He says, "To Paris." I says, "Where's the 1st Division now? Where's our headquarters?" The division headquarters says, "Over at Meaux, M-E-O-U-X, just east of Paris." I says, the Germans still there, aren't they? He says, "No, they went through there yesterday." So we went through. Now, my buddy, the Irishman, had lived in Lille. He had been in Paris before as a kid, so he knew where to go. And we went to the Folies Bergère. It was like the Moulin Rouge. In the front, they had these can-can girls. And in the back, they had an entrance there, and we went in there, and the guys, all you could see officers, Americans, 1st Division, everything. The girls up above on rings, new girls. You see the picture of her up there? Well, he picked out a brunette, and she picked me out. I spent the night with her. I was a virgin until I was 21. That's why I never had a complete loving, a loving loving sort of way, the next morning I hear voices outside the door, and I pulled my pants on. I went out there, and this my buddy says, "What the hell kind of a man are you?" I says, "What do you mean? What happened?" He says, "She said you did it 8 times last night." I said, I don't know who's keeping score. So I spent 2 weeks with her. She took me around the city, and I guess he stayed with his girlfriend too. And anyway, she took me around the city, to Saint-Cancur, Notre Dame. We went up the Eiffel Tower. And you had to walk, and now they have elevators, but we had to walk up there, and the first elevation there where the legs go up before they go up straight vertically, there was a restaurant up at the top there. But there was no food, no restaurant operating. It was just to go up there and see the city. Mm-hmm. And we went down. We'd been there, and we went down. They sell you a postcard at the bottom, and a picture of the Tour Eiffel, if you want to call it the French name, Eiffel Tower, and they stamped the date on there. Well, that night, I don't know whether deliberately or accidentally, she spilled her perfume on there. I like to think it was deliberate, because I had that postcard for 20 years, and I could still smell it. I never could find out what it was. One time I was in St. Thomas. I was walking down the street, and a woman ahead with one of my second wife, and a woman ahead of me, I could smell it. My God, I ran to catch up with her. I'm not mad at her, pardon me, but I told her what the story was. I said, "What is the name of that scent you're wearing?" And it says, Saint-Cancur by Chanel. And they were still making it then. They don't make it anymore. They make a Chanel I don't know, they have a substitute for it. But anyway, I never forgot that scent. And my God. I love that girl, even today. She was one woman I would like to have a baby with. I would. And she loved me dearly. And I caught up with the outfit over at Mo, just getting ready to leave. They're bivouacked out there, and they were going over to Belgium, and some Germans had accumulated there, and they're getting resistance, and so I went with them to Mons in Belgium. There was a big battle there. We had a lot of casualties, and then we went up to through there. We went to through Liège, Belgium, and then to Aachen. The first major city that we captured, and it was just west of Cologne. And they had had orders from Hitler not to surrender. I like to, you saw a picture in there of the guys going in with, under a flag of truce. The guy carrying the flag had broke both legs on D-Day, and he insisted on going. Mm. We were good. Mm. We were all good in those days. Nobody shirked their duty except Fred. Christ. But anyway, at Aachen, they sent a flag men under a flag of truce. There were 26,000 German troops in Aachen. They wanted that city, and they weren't going to let us have it. So they sent men in under truce, and they're completely surrounded. And they told them that that you are completely surrounded, we're not going to disturb the city any, but we don't want to. What I like about this is it showed our humanity. The guys were going in there to give them a chance to surrender to save lives, and property, and they were so they gave them 24 hours. At the end of 24 hours, our artillery opened up, and the planes came over. Mustangs and P-38s and bomb and artillery opened up. In 10 days, there was 6,000 left alive, and then they surrendered. But before that happened, I got wounded. Got one right there. Same place. Same thing. I was sitting out there on a litter, and it was raining and freezing. And I got malaria again.
God.
Jesus Christ. And I had to wait there 2 hours before they got an ambulance full to take us to a hospital in Liège, Belgium, a civilian hospital. And when they got enough there, they sent them on a train by train. There was a train load going down to La Bourget Airport. La Bourget Airport is on the north side of Paris. And that is where Charles Lindbergh landed in 1926. And I remember that. Going to Charles de Gaulle Airport from Paris, from Gare du Nord, you still go past La Bourget Airport. And I never go past there. I don't get a thrill thinking about it. I got down there. The train got there. I think it had square wheels. It was rough. And then there was an officer in there. And he was acting like Section 8. A Section 8 is a guy that's lost his marbles. And he was putting on a storm. He wanted to get discharged, metal discharge or something, you know. I got over mine, but he did. He didn't. And he was trying. He was acting. Now, nobody believed him. I mean, he's acting cuckoo, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody believed him. They said, "Hey, straighten up and fly right, man. You do your job." These guys, both of them, are really wounded, bad guys, you know. And this disgusted them. It's like the kid down there to the Florida Artillery Observation Post. "Hey, mister, take me with you. I'm going to get killed here." Yeah, Jesus Christ, that turned me off. And that guy turned, that officer turned us off. So we got down to La Bougie Airport, and we're at planes that were going to be flown over. They're waiting for planes to come in and take us, C-47s to fly us over to England to the hospital. So when I got down there, I said, my God, there's Metro. I said, Jesus, Ilian's on the other side of that Metro. Her name was Ilian Matti. I was bleeding here. I had a temperature. Nothing would do, but I had to get down and get on the goddamn Metro. Nobody used money. They just got on the train and went. So I got down where I used to meet her nights when she got through work. I mud in there and I laid down. I was about 10, 15 minutes and she came in. She says, Pourquoi vous êtes ici? I says, Petit malade. I was sicker than a dog. And trying to make, you know, and she comes over, she feels my head, my own mandu, and she ran out the door. And I said, now, you dumb bastard, you lost her. You scared her off. And I said, I better get my ass back out to the airport, get over to the hospital. And I wouldn't feel too good. I lost some blood, and the temperature from the malaria wouldn't do me any good. But before I could leave there, I got up and I hear people coming up the stairs, and an American voice says, "What's this about America? A soldier up here that's wounded and he's got a temperature." And he came in as an MP. She went out and got an MP. See, she loved me. She wanted to get me taken care of. Hmm. Right?
Yep. Yeah.
She really did. She really did. And I told him the story. I said, I just came here to get a hug and a kiss. I said, I couldn't get it up if I wanted to. I didn't want it. I just wanted to see her and get a hug and a kiss because I was going over to England. God knows what's going to happen to me. And he said, well, go get your hug and a kiss, and I'll take you out back to the airport. So I got a hug and a kiss, and he took me out to the airport. And I went over to the airport. I got a letter from him when I was over there. But then I was there, I was supposed to be recuperating, but the bulge just happened, just occurred. They were getting buku casualties, a lot of casualties. And they had to get you out of there. So they sent me, they sent us all back. And they sent us to a rest camp near Compiègne. And right south of Compiègne, there's a little town with a chateau in there. The most exquisite building I ever saw outside of Notre Dame in Paris. That's the most beautiful building in the world. But this was the next one to it. And it was there 30 days. I was in charge of the place, and then they took us loaded us on trucks and took us out there. But they had people on, they're being paid by Lend-Lease. Yeah. They're refugees from Belgium, Holland, and like that, Luxembourg, and they cooked our food, made our beds, and they had men out in the yard there and like that. But that was an exquisite place. I never could find that place where we billeted. There was about 40 or 50 of us. And I was in charge of it. I was a ranking non-com. And then we got back just about the time, right at the end of the bulge. And we went through the Hürtgen Forest, and we got to Cologne. It was just south of Cologne. They had been made aware that there was a crematory up ahead of us. And the general, Hübner, had arranged for a field hospital to be built immediately to take care of these guys. And they were crawling in this crematory. We went in there. Some of the Germans would crawl into the ovens to hide, and the guys would sit there and shoot, empty their cartridges into them, empty their magazines into them. These guys, these Jews in there, I don't know, they weren't all Jews. Jehovah's Witnesses, anything. Anybody that disagreed with Hitler, boy, that's where they went. And these guys were crawling on their hands and knees. They couldn't stand up. They'd get to a fence and pull themselves up. And they couldn't swallow water. They couldn't. We had to lay them down on a litter and get an IV in them. And then we got an ambulance full. We sent them back to the hospital there. We emptied that out that day.
How big was it?
It was a small one. There was another one that we later that they liberated. If you ever saw that, you wouldn't. You know, I mean, it was. Anybody says that there wasn't such a thing as full of shit. Believe me, it was there. I saw it. These people were skin and bones. They couldn't swallow water.
What did you do? I mean, once you had them on the IV, how quickly could they start?
Well, we got them out to the field hospital. They let them sit there a few days. They get nourishment into them, and then they sent them on back, where they got some of them needed extensive rehabilitation. It was ghastly. It was ghastly. And we were still, we were in after we left there, we were in a German town, and we didn't see any Germans in this town. But later we did. We found them in other towns where we were in. And we were, there was a woman that went past us. She had two little kids and she had a German greatcoat on. And one of the guys, I was with three riflemen there, was walking down a street. And they had their rifles ready. And the one guy with me kept looking back, and all of a sudden he looked back, he raised his rifle and shot. She'd pull a rifle up out of the greatcoat and was going to kill us.
Wow.
And maybe other women would have done the same thing as here. I don't know. What is another thing that used to disturb me was it happened in Tunisia and Belgium and even in France. At the end of our chow line where we were in bivouac, we would see people, civilians from the towns that were out there. Some of them had tailored suits on, fur coats, and we were, our slops would take it, would throw it in a barrel, and they had a container, they wanted it. And so usually this happened for a few days, and we would load up on whatever was good so that we could give them enough. And I thought to myself then, I hope never to see that in my country. So when the war was over, I was near, Le Havre. I lay on the field where I feel a rat running over my face at night. A guy come up to me and said, "Hey, you haven't had a furlough since you've been here, have you?" Well, at this point, I didn't think about anything except getting to the USA. Now, I'd been overseas 3 years. People over there were friendly. They'd speak to him. You see him on the street, they'd speak to him. So he asked me, he said, "You know, you never had a furlough." He said, "Would you like 2 weeks? You can go to two places. You either go to Switzerland or Scotland." And stupid me. If I had it to do over, I would have said, I'll go to Switzerland if I can take my fiancée with me. And I would have gone, got Ilian and taken her with me. Later I wished I had, but I didn't. I wanted to get out of there.
Were you exhausted?
Huh?
Were you exhausted?
Yeah, sure. Physically and emotionally. I was getting nightmares then. And it wasn't a very pleasant place. And I walked down, I was discharged at Fort Dix, New Jersey. And I got Newark, New Jersey. People walking down the street, Americans. No sign of war, nothing. You say hello, they just ignore you. Walk past. Nobody spoke to you. And I thought, Jesus Christ, I think I ought to go back over there. Man, that was really disheartening. People you see in the street. I called my aunt. She was an English professor at New York University. She lived up in Washington Heights. And I called her. And I went up to her apartment. And she says, well, your brother's over the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Why don't you go see him? I said, I don't want to see that son of a bitch. When I was out in Pasadena, he came and insulted me. I'll go see him. So I went over to see him. He'd been out in the Pacific. He'd done his bit. He was a good man. He died at 48 of a heart attack. The only one that lived, my sister Ruth, she died at 96 about 2 years ago last September.
Wow.
And she died in California, and I went out there to her funeral. But she and I were, I had a brother and four sisters, and she was the only one I was a friend. We exchanged confidants, and she was a friend, and I loved Ruth. The others, your relatives, you like them there, but what the hell? No feeling there. But Ruth, I had feeling for.
Did the Army have any sort
She had a nurse. She was a nurse. Huh?
Did the Army have any sort of counseling, psychological counseling?
No, we didn't think about it. They didn't have any antidepressants in those days. And I would wake up at night. And what the hell did I do wrong? That guy died. What could I have done different? Now, one guy, I told you this before, I didn't put it on record, but I'll tell you now. A guy came in and his his hands over his stomach, and as they were bulging out there. And I said, hey, what do you got in your hands? And he dropped his hands, looked, and there's his intestines, a piece of shrapnel going right across his abdomen, and sliced it open, and he wasn't bleeding much, very little, and there was no pain for there. So we laid him down, tucked his intestines back in, and wrapped them up, and set him back. And then we gave him a shot of morphine because of the shock. He wasn't in any pain, but he's going to be in shock when he realized what was happening. And so we sent him back. And another time, a guy come stumbling in. His buddy was helping him. He was leaning on his buddy, and his right leg was shattered just below the knee to the top of his boot. There was completely nothing there. And the only thing that's holding the foot onto the rest of the leg was a sciatic nerve. And a sciatic nerve is a little bit bigger than a pencil lead, and it's tough. I mean, it's tough gristle. And he had a, he had, he, we gave him morphine. And I try to cut the nerve where the shears had just slid off. The guy screamed. So I gave him another shot of morphine. That's all I could give him was a two. I could give him more than that. I could put him in shock and kill him. But then I used a scalpel. I tried to cut it with a scalpel, and it wouldn't cut. I mean, that's the nerves are tough. The body's a tough piece of material. So I laid his foot out, and I got a block of wood underneath there, and I had a mallet, and I took the scalpel and I hit the scalpel with a mallet, and that he screamed and passed out. And that was that seared the nerve, and so I went back. So that was
So what did you do after your discharge? You were in New York for a while.
Another time, I got another one I'll tell. Relate. You want to hear?
Sure.
Okay. Well, there's another time a guy was brought in. I had a doctor. There was a doctor there, a thin, weazened up guy, tall, from Texas, anything. He was just the opposite of these aggressive, arrogant bastards that come out of Texas. But anyway, he was a wonderful doctor. He was tops. He performed miracles. This guy came in, he had, he was white as that paper right there. And he lost, blood in his left lung. And he was on the litter, and we were we took a big spinal needle, and we put it. We had a big syringe. We put it into the left lung cavity, and then we had another one over here on the right arm. We put the we had three syringes working, and. This went on over half an hour. Pretty soon you could see the color come back in his cheeks. And they weren't getting so much blood through the, they were drawing out. It was slowing, it was coagulating in there. And pretty soon his cheeks were pink, and he was talking and sassy and beautiful. My God. It was a beautiful thing to see. And we let him stay there that night because we were afraid to send him back in an ambulance. There's no helicopters in those days. So if you send him back in an ambulance, the roads are rough and it could break loose a clot and he'd bleed to death on the way back. So we kept him there overnight, which we weren't supposed to do, but we had to. But we did. And the next day we sent him back. That was one of my nightmares. I woke up in the middle of the night and I said, ah, I know how I could have kept that guy alive. I would have had two men, one on each end of the litter. It wasn't a half, three quarters of an hour ride on the ambulance back to the field hospital. And they could have held him inside and act like shock absorbers. And that would have kept him from getting bounced. See, later he becomes bright. Genius. I wonder if he lived. It was a beautiful thing to see. You worried later. Oh, you worried at the time. But I didn't think about it then. If I'd have thought about it then, I'd have put man on each end of the litter in the ambulance holding him so that he wouldn't get joust. Terrible. What are you going to do? But he came in and he was as white as that paper. And then he is just as pink as you are now. Mm. Beautiful. Beautiful to see.
Came right back to life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. He was dead. That was one of my nightmares. You know, when I had nightmares, I'd wake up, and by that time, your adrenaline's pumping. The best thing you can do is to get up and go for a hike. I would go for a hike for 2 hours. And they tell me that today some of these guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan They're giving them these antidepressants, and they're not relieving the anxiety. And even today, if I feel any depressed or something worrying me, if I got something bothering me, I could go out and go for a hike for a couple hours, and it disappears. If you feel better, mm-hmm. and I would tell it that's what I would tell these. I've told them over there at the hospital. I'd tell them to go for a hike for a couple hours, and that'll dissipate the exercise produces an adrenaline that gives you the joyous feeling, happy feeling. So that was. I had to leave there. I got back to the States, and I went to the bank. I was 20 before I went over. I was 21, and I started this account with a bank. And nobody should have had access. It was in there, it was in the agreement in there that if I died, it would go to my mother. But until I died, that money stayed in that bank account. I went to the bank and it was empty. When I was overseas, I was corporal and I had allotment going to the bank. And then I made staff sergeant and they had another allotment. They didn't discontinue the one from corporal until they had $1,090 in my account, in excess of what they more than they should have paid me. So they're down there. They went to the house and they told my mother that they were going to put me in jail if she didn't pay me. And if it had been me, I would have told them to go to hell. I wouldn't have paid them. I said, what are you going to do? They said, well, we would have kept you in and made you a master sergeant and confiscated your money and then turned you loose. And that would have been great because then I would have been discharged as a master sergeant. I would have paid. And then I would have been $1,090. I should have had $4,500 in that account. There was nothing there. I told my mother about it. She said, well, your brother has his allotment coming to me. I said, he's married and got a family. You ought to be ashamed of taking it. My mother was a greedy person. My God, how could she do this? You're over there giving your all for the cause. And she's there taking your money. I had no respect for her, even today. She destroyed my father. She denigrated him. Talked to me. Say, do you want to grow up to be like your father? He was a nice guy. That's why in that book, I dedicated a book to him. He was good at figures. He was worked for the North American Bridge Company, and he used to take me with him out in the Catskills. I went with him one couple of times. He'd drive around. He'd show me a bridge that he had built and a creamery he had built. He was proud of this. He was a bright man. If he had the right woman, he'd have been a millionaire. He was good at figures, and he was a good worker. I went up to Quaker Lake. It was a place where people, a lot of wealthy people had second homes, summer homes up there. And he built a fireplace, and it was the most exquisite thing I ever saw. It was really, and he was really proud of that, you know. And when he got the fireplace done, he'd take a newspaper and light it there to see that the flue, that the flue was drawing properly. He was a good craftsman in his trade, and he was an engineer for the bridge company, and he was a brick mason, and he was a great man.
Was he still alive when you got back from the war?
Yeah, I told her. I said, I want my money. If I had known then what I know now, I would have gone to a lawyer and made the bank would have been responsible for that money, all that money. You could ask for their records, and I want that money or I'll take you to court. Mm-hmm. They violated a contract. Mm-hmm. She gave me some money, but I didn't get $1,000. But she had, Jesus, taking money from my brother. He was married and had a family. He was a damn fool giving it to her.
So what did you do after you got back and you found out you had no money?
Well, I got $1,000 from her, and I had a pension, a temporary pension, 10% disability pension, and for 1 year. And so I was bothering people at home because I was waking up nights, and I'd get dressed and go out the door, go for a hike for a couple of hours, come back to bed. That bothered people. I had to wake them up. Or I didn't wake them up, but they were being... So I left there. I left Binghamton. I went down to Phoenix. I had a sister down there, and I stayed there. And the same thing. And I was there for a month or two, and I left there. I went out to California. It was where Ruth. And the same thing there. I was bothering people, wake them up in the middle of the night. And I says, and I went up to Spokane, Washington. I worked in a dental clinic up there for a while. But same thing, though. I was staying in a boarding house, and people were getting pissed off at my waking them up in the middle of the night. So I said, well, maybe I'll go up to Canada, go to Montreal. No, I remember when I was going to school in New York, I went to NYU, I met these doctors from Caracas. So they kept asking me down, inviting me down to Caracas. You know, they saw I was good, mm-hmm. and they wanted me down there. They kept inviting me down. At that time, I had no money. But now I said, I'll go to Caracas. So I went down to Caracas, expecting to spend 2 or 3 weeks. And I went to this doctor's house, and he had a spare room, and I stayed in that. And they said, I gotta leave. My visa's expired, and I can't. They said, well, you gotta work here. I said, I don't have a work permit. I can't work here. We'll get you a work permit. 2 days I had a work permit. I made double there what I had made in the States. So I stayed there for 6 months. I got over my dream nightmare there. Different language, different city. I love Caracas. I loved it. I loved Venezuela. I love the people down there are different than they are in other Latin American countries. They're more intelligent, and they're nice people. I don't know how the hell they voted that Chavez in for a. But anyway, he won't stay long. But somebody will. Kill him or vote him out of office. So, but it was a nice place. So I went back and I met Margaret. I should have gone over to France, got alien. But I met Margaret, and so we got married. And she'd been married before, and her husband, he's cheating on her the night that they were married. And he was a drunk, and he'd go out and he fell in the snow a year later and got pneumonia and died. So she was a widow, and she got pregnant from him, and he made her get an abortion. So we were married 6 months, and she told me she couldn't get pregnant. She had a tipped uterus. I must have straightened it out. In 6 months, she was pregnant. She said, you want me to have an abortion? I said, what the hell do I know about raising a kid? I mean, I came from a dysfunctional family. You've been around them. You saw what they're like. What the hell do I know about raising a kid? She says, I'll tell you a small show. I said, you know what she said? Let me help you. I said, you're going to have two of us to raise. She says, no, you'll do all right. I would have, she'd lived. It was everything I ever wanted. We had a close, loving family. The little girl, I carry on like that going up Black Mountain, or we'd go out hiking in the woods, and I'd show her where the teddy bears had their picnic, see a picnic table. Really? It's wonderful.
This is in New York.
It was up in Glens Falls, New York.
Okay.
It was between Albany and Lake George. If you're familiar with that neck of the woods.
No, I'm from there.
Huh?
I'm from upstate New York.
What about?
Skinny Atlas. Just
Well, hell, I was born in Binghamton.
Yeah, no, I know.
Skinny Atlas.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, hell, you're there. You're just west of Elmira. My father's born in Elmira.
Yeah.
My father remembered Mark Twain. He saw him sitting on a porch. White-haired guy.
Amazing.
My father used to tell me stories about his father. They don't jibe with what's... And he told it to me in all good faith, and I'm sure he didn't make this up. But he told me stories. And a story he told me that his grandfather came over here, and he went to Connecticut to marry this Welsh girl, and she died in childbirth. He became disconsolate. He went to St. Joseph, Missouri. He joined a wagon train, went to California to the Gold Rush, and has gone 2 years, came back, went to Montpelier, no, to Barry, Vermont. That was the granite capital of the United States. And he was there for a while. Then he went down to Connecticut again, where he married my grandmother. And they had children that died, young children. And then they had three more, my father, his brother, and his sister. My mother would let us know our father's family. So when Dad died, we went down, Margaret went down with me, and you know, Peggy was about 12 years old. And it was just before Margaret died. And on the way, being there, they were talking and sitting in there, wondering who's alive in Dad's family. And he said, his sister May's alive. And she lived up on Linden Avenue. And I said to Margaret, I said, you know, we go right past there on the way home. I'm going to stop there and see her. My mother got up and shouted at the top of her lungs, I forbid you to go there. Everybody looked at her like the kook that she was. And I said, lady, you're not going to tell me where I'm going to go or I'm not going to go. And I stopped there and saw a little wheezing up old woman, 20-watt bulb hanging down the ceiling there. I don't know, I'm too upset. I didn't think about it. I should have given her some money. She probably was going to use some. I didn't think about it. But I met my father's sister, or May. Her brother, his brother Lou, was an engineer on the railroad. And so Margaret died. But that's another story. You want to hear the rest of that?
You can do that next time.
Yeah.
You want to do that?
Yeah.